universe that leaves us out? Will it be mammals, or will it be fish or insects? Now, it occurs to me that the fish are in a very stable environment, so they aren't meeting up with changes all the time that are very serious, and their chances are much better than man's, I'd say. And also, they've been around for a couple hundred million years, getting along pretty well. The forms of life in the sea. In wondering about the future, and without actually trying to make a horoscope of humanity or of life on the Earth, I've just tried to list down sometimes what are the risks we suffer. What will eliminate man if he is eliminated from the surface of the Earth? Will it be the sun running down or blowing up, either one of those, freezing man out or incinerating him? No, because the sun's a good steady star, as you know. It's pretty well thermostated to run for, say, 10,000 million years at its present rate, so the sun isn't going to play out. How about stars colliding with us? No, they're too far apart. Collisions would happen too infrequently. Say, in the next 1,000 centuries, no chance of that. I mean, a very low chance. Well, how about the Earth getting out of its orbit and running away and freezing to death in empty space? Or plunging into the sun and boiling up? No chance. We know from our celestial mechanics that the orbit of the Earth is constant and will stay just about put. So I think we're safe from sun, from star, from Earth. So now, must I say, that it looks pretty safe on man. For this future you talk about for the next 1,000 centuries? Yes, no. Because he had one deadly enemy that I didn't mention, an enemy that's at his throat and may succeed in returning him to the fossils and leaving life on the Earth to the cockroaches and the kelp. You know what that enemy is, of course? That's man himself. Man's his own worst enemy, and he may succeed in carrying out that horrible assignment of getting the Earth clean of mankind. I don't believe that's going to happen, but that's where my optimism comes in. I should like to think that we are going to recognize that we must change with our environment. If we get too conservative, too constant in our way of living, and the environment changes, well then, we're trouble. And that's been the trouble of the dinosaurs, the trouble of the saber-toothed tigers, the trouble with the thousands of mammals that died out some tens of millions of years ago as the mountains were rising and the weather was changing. No. If we can only adjust ourselves to our environment, and you know what I have in mind when I talk about environment? I'm thinking of that atom. There is the change that's come, the big warfare possible. The atom that can make a great future for us, a wonderful life ahead if it is the tamed atom. But the wild atom, that's the finish.
Because you see, again, what probably has given me my vision is that I have not been caught in cliché. When I was growing up, it was fashionable, if you were pretty, to say, well, she's pretty, beauty is skin deep. Well, beauty is not skin deep, beauty is beauty. In other words, I would like to say that the whole thing that we're talking about has one note in my life, as you can see, and that is the important thing to me. Now, another thing, let us take Beethoven, just because everyone knows Beethoven, and we're talking about his time and in the Occidental world. Now, we have octaves in music, and that's eight notes, and then some half notes. And out of eight notes, he built a world of sound. All the things that he created are really out of eight notes. Now, those eight notes go higher, an octave higher, octave lower, but there are only eight notes in an octave. Now, I only need one note, and that is my note of consciousness. And that is what I want more of, my own consciousness.
How do you think that that relates to a house in the land? Thank you.
and give up this expedition just when success seems assured? Never. I have begun this journey and I mean to finish it. Listen to the proposal I want to put to you. The lack of water is the only obstacle in our way. In the Eastern Gallery, made of lava, schist, and coal, we haven't found a single drop of moisture. We may be more fortunate if we follow the Western Tunnel. I have examined the course of that gallery. It plunges straight into the bowels of the earth, and in a few hours, it will bring us to the granite mass. There, we are bound to find abundant springs. I am asking you for only one day more. If, after one day, I have not found the water we need, I swear to you that we will return to the surface. The descent began again, this time by the new gallery. We hadn't gone 100 yards before the professor, passing his lamp along the wall, cried, "These are primitive rocks. Now we are on the right track. Forward!" The beams from our lamps, reflected by the tiny facets of rocky mass, crisscrossed in all directions, so that I felt as if I were walking through a hollow diamond inside which the rays were shattering against each other. About 6 o'clock, this festival of light abated to a noticeable extent and almost ceased. We were immured in a huge prison of granite. It was now 8 in the evening, and there was still no sign of water. I was suffering agonies of thirst. My uncle strode on, listening for the murmur of some spring, but there was nothing to be heard. At last, my strength gave out completely. I gave a cry and fell. "Help! I'm dying!" My uncle turned back. He gazed at me with his arms folded and then muttered, "It's all over." The last thing I saw was a frightening gesture of rage before I closed my eyes. We had nearly 4 miles of the Earth's crust above us, and this mass seemed to be bearing down with all its weight on my shoulders. I felt crushed. A few hours went by. A profound silence like that of a grave reigned around us. Yet in the midst of my drowsiness, I thought I heard a noise. It seemed to me that I could see the Icelander disappearing with the lamp in his hand. I tried to shout that Hans was abandoning us, but my voice couldn't break through my parched lips. For a whole hour, my delirious brain passed in review all the reasons which might have roused our guide to action. But at last, I heard the sound of footsteps in the depths of the abyss. Hans reappeared. He went up to my uncle and gently woke him. "Martin," said the guide.
"Water! Water!"
I cried.
"Water?"
repeated my uncle.
"Where?"
Hans pointed back the way he had come. We were soon making our way down the slope of 1 in 3. Half an hour later, we had gone 1.25 miles and were 2,000 feet farther down. At that moment, I distinctly heard an unfamiliar sound traveling through the granite walls, a sort of dull rumbling like distant thunder. "Hans was not mistaken," my uncle said. "What you can hear is the roar of a torrent, there's no doubt about it. A subterranean river is flowing around us." The torrent was now roaring and leaping along inside the left-hand wall. Hans stopped at the exact spot where the torrent seemed closest to us. I could hear the water rushing past me with extreme violence about 2 feet away, but a granite wall still separated us from it. Hans went up to the wall. He pressed his ear against the dry stone, trying to find the exact spot where the noise of the torrent was loudest. I saw him seize his pickaxe and attack the rock. Soon the pickaxe had penetrated 2 feet into the granite wall. My uncle wanted to join in himself. Indeed, he had just taken hold of his pickaxe when a sudden hissing was heard.
jet of water shot out of the hole and broke against the opposite wall. The spring was scalding hot. The corridor was filling with steam, and a rivulet formed and was running away down the hill. Soon, we were able to take our first bath. Although it was still warm, water went into the stardust.
What a splendid discovery Hans has made. I propose we should give his name to this health-giving stream. And the name of Hansbach is probably missed.
Ages. There, I think, the essence of his house is the human element, the procession through the building. I once counted the turns that you make. You approach the building till you get into what he calls the cove. And the number of turns, I think, was 45. Now, he is playing with you as you walk through that space. He stops your car, as any good architect should, 200-300 feet from the entrance. It doesn't rain enough to make any difference. But then you start down the steps, up the steps, to the left, to the right, down along a very long pergola, and you turn to the right to get out onto that famous prow. And you take those few steps down onto the magnificent view that you've been concealed. It's been concealed from you for 200-300 feet of walking. Okay? Then you see Arizona stretched out as he meant it to you. And then you turn and go into the little tent room where the man, of course, understands light better than anybody in the world, and he has this tent light that trickles, filters down through into this private room before he opens any flaps. You're just bathed in this canvas light. Then when he opens the flap onto the little secret garden, you say, I can't, there are no more surprises. There can't be any more unfolding of spaces. But there are. And you get into this private courtyard with the green grass and the falling water, which I notice he's just changed. He now has a series of round circular paths surrounding the seat. And then you finally get into the cove, and just when you're used to Frank Lloyd Wright's 6-foot ceiling, it has a 14-foot ceiling. And the fireplace runs the full length of the building. There are no windows all of a sudden, and no canvas. You're entirely enclosed in the middle of this experience. And by the time you get there, you've realized that you've been handled and twisted much as a symphony will until you get to the crisis. That, perhaps, is not even architecture.